There was a bus driver who went to church and sat in the first pew. And after the church was over, the minister said, "Well, tell me, why were you sitting in the first pew?" He says, "I was trying to learn your technique." He says, "Of how you got people to move to the back of the bus. May I invite you in the back to move to the front?" I'm going to take advantage of my position as chairman this afternoon to say a few words about this wonderful library, because I feel so intimately connected with it, and I'm so delighted to be here in this time of dedication. First, I think it is so fortunate that it is named after Mr. Rasmussen, who has devoted himself to the scholarly aspects of this university, because I think the library, more than any other building, does represent the center of scholarship for teacher, student, researcher, extension worker. This is the rallying point, and I think that it is most significant and most appropriate. Secondly, it is known among the circles of higher education that the growth of libraries is always associated with the personality of the president of the institution at a particular time. Libraries grow under some presidents. They decline or maintain themselves under others. But there is a direct correlation. And I think in this case, special tribute is due to Dr. Wood, who I feel in part when I see what he has done in the library and the campus and the time he's been here, has followed pretty much the gypsy prayer, which says, "I never asked you to give me, Lord, but only to put me where I can get at it." And it seems to me that Dr. Wood has successfully demonstrated this thing about really never asking so much, but if he got close enough to get at it. But that's just about all he needed for success in helping build this university. Of course, the idea of this wonderful building was started long before I came, and I'm not sure where the first germ was set, but I know that George Adams was the chairman of the first committee that met to consider the very first steps of defining what are the functions of a library and what are the dimensions of its need. He called the first committee meeting, and then, shortly after that, I arrived. Things seemed to bog down a little bit after that. The committee continued to reassemble, and we began to define what we thought would be the needs and the functions. started out by getting a consultant by the name of Don Davidson at the University of California at Santa Barbara. I don't expect more than one of two of you to know that he was even here on campus to help us in the original planning of the library. Then I was fortunate in meeting with Ted Reimer. And I felt a little guilty at times as the years passed, as our barometer of hope and despair rose and fell in the building of the acquiring of the library, because I think I enticed him here in part because of the great challenge that it would be to have an opportunity to work in the making of this great building. I remember meeting with the library committee, and then with Bill O'Neill and Ben Atkinson to help in the particular planning, and then off to Washington to find a former teacher of Bill Woods and mine in the Office of Education, who just happened to have charge of delegating or the funds for the building of libraries. Professor John Ashton, who had been academic vice president at Indiana University and then was in Washington, D.C. And I feel that it was his close contact with Bill Wood that made it possible for us in a crucial timing period to get a fund commitment a year in advance of what we had thought we would do, because Bill was able to entice him here on the last weeks of John Ashton's being in office. And for all I know, it was the last thing that he signed was the approval of the funds here. And once we got him on campus, believe you me, we twisted his arm strongly because of this time business. Then there was the preparing of a type of report that would make it possible to get these funds. And you know how bureaucratic some of these requirements must be. And here was a thrilling experience for me. Ted Ryberg had turned over to Paul McCarthy the problem of making a proper appeal and proposal to the Office of Education. Now, the Office of Education was concerned with facts, but we were mostly concerned with hopes. Now, how do you bring together the facts and the hopes? And it's through the long hours of work of Paul and Ted that they presented or produced a document based not upon the facts of what the University of Alaska library volume size was and circulation size was, but what it should be to properly support the academic and research program of the University of Alaska. Now, the chairman of the committee, Olaf Stanberg, in Washington, the committee that was to come to investigate it, reported that he looked at the folder and he said, oh, here's another application. And he took it home one night and said, well, I read it through, a routine thing. He said, I stayed up most of the night. He said, this was the first and most full presentation he had ever found of the Clapp-Jordan formula for a library needs and construction. And he said it was carried out so beautifully that he got so excited that he was reading it up to 2:30 in the morning. This was the basis upon which the presentation was made, which made it possible for us to get some part of the funds. And let me not neglect, of course, the dedication of the funds of the people of the state of Alaska, lest one think that only the federal government contributes to this effort. These, then, are just some of the incidents behind the building of this library, in which I had the great pleasure and privilege to participate in. I don't know much what happened during the construction period. And I was asking Ted Ryberg today about it, and you know, he was gone during some of that time. He said, really, I'd have to talk to Bill Smith and Paul McCarthy. It's sort of like the child who was asked in school, write everything you know about the Last Supper. And he replied, I'm sorry I wasn't there. I had the measles that day. And so during the construction period, I'm afraid I will have to leave that a story to some others. Well, having indulged more than really is the privilege of the chairman on time, let me turn to the subject this afternoon. Uses and abuses of the library. And we have a very distinguished panel here that is my function to try to stimulate a little bit to get started, and really knowing most of them as I do, I don't think there's going to be much difficulty getting them started. I'll try to watch the mics lest they get away from us too long. I think we will begin by allowing each to make a statement on the uses and abuses so that we would have this variety of experience from those who have been not only in this but in many libraries. And I would like to start by calling upon Dr. George Worthington Adams, who was the first academic vice president, University of Alaska, currently at Southern Illinois University, professor of history, having gone through the many chairs of administration, he now enjoys that distinguished position of professor. George, what about uses and abuses?
Mr. Cutler, I would certainly hope to contribute something about uses and abuses, but if you, as the second academic vice president, have the right to make a speech, I have the right to make a shorter speech. So I will say that although it's been hinted by the kind Cutler that I had something to do in the germination of the great accomplishment you see today, I will confess I had very little to do with it. Mrs. Adams and I are not here because of our desserts, but because of our good intentions. And I remember that there was a committee. I remember that we called a meeting. I don't remember much more. And then I can only say that what I did do was that I had the grace to withdraw myself from the position of academic vice president to make room for the distinguished Mr. Cutler, who would then carry on in this fine way and lead to these fine results. About uses and abuses, I've lived a long life connected with libraries in one way or another, but when I was being done the distinct honor of being invited here for this occasion, I felt that homework was in order. So I asked the assistant librarian of the Morris Library at Southern Illinois University, which is one of the remarkable new libraries in the world, for a bibliography, which would really bring me abreast of current trends in university libraries. He gave me a great big canvas sack that had 50 pounds of stuff in it, and I read 37 articles. It took most of 2 days, and I don't know much more than I did when I started, but at least I have a certain orientation I didn't have before. And one thing that was impressed upon me to start out with abuses is that I think that mankind really doesn't deserve its libraries. That the people who use libraries are getting nastier and nastier as the libraries are getting better and better, and it's driving the librarians up the wall. I've been aware as a teacher of history that if you assign an article in a publication, that you can well expect that somebody is going to clip it out of the article in the magazine that's going to disappear. And for a long time, I just thought, well, this is mankind's cruel, selfish way. He wants for himself. He doesn't want to have to sit in the library. He wants to take it home and read it in bed, so he cuts it out of the bound volume. But then I began to find out that mankind was even more devious than I had thought, and that many people clip it out because they do not wish other people to have it. They wish to be Mr. Brighty, who has read the assignment, and the other people are unable to do it. Now, that makes you feel rather despairing about the human race. Now, when we get on to further abuses of libraries, and I might add this is a serious thing, there is, of course, also the business of the disappearance of books. When I was a graduate student at Harvard in the late 20s and early 30s, Widener was still a place where you just walked in and out, and nobody checked your books. Then they began to have such serious book losses that they put in a turnstile and a man near the door who made you show that what you were taking out and to see that it was properly stamped and so forth and so on. That was the beginning of it. Well, then everybody heaved a great sigh of relief because a couple of years later it was discovered that a middle-aged graduate student who lived in a suburb had stolen more than 4,000 volumes from Widener, most of them very choice, because he had an excellent bibliographical knowledge, and that he had his whole house full of the things, and that he had them down in the basement, and he had them under all the beds, and he had them all over the place. And everybody thought, well, isn't this fine? Isn't mankind at fault? It's this SOB. And he was put behind the bars and served a long penitentiary sentence, and people breathed a sigh of relief. Fine, now a thing is safe. But it wasn't safe. Because, as I've said, the world is getting worse and worse about the abuse of these splendid facilities. Now, I don't mean to take up a vast amount more time, so I would merely like to add that I do think that the technology that is coming into libraries is going to be a very fine way to help guard against many of these abuses, because the facility with which Xeroxing can be done and that kind of thing means that when you wish to assign things, you don't assign them. You tell the librarian you want Xeroxes made of this and so, and then he keeps the bound volume where it's under control, and the Xeroxes are put in the reserve room, and people use them, and there is a hope for the future. The number of things that are getting on tapes and films, one thing and another, in addition to books, is, of course, another way to assist in control, although it's by no means foolproof, of course. We are told by the chemists that the kind of paper we've been using for most of the last 50 years is so constructed that it's all going to fall to pieces within 100 years and there won't be any books left, and that therefore they're all going to have to be reproduced on tapes or whatnot before very long, except those that came out more than 50 years ago and those that come out in the future on new kinds of paper. Well, now, after making this honest acknowledgement of practical ignorance but personal acquaintance with some difficulties, I think I'm going to say I pass and allow my colleagues to get in on this act.
Thank you, George. I'd say from a historian's point of view, that was rather a pessimistic look at mankind here getting worse is the library thing, but you know, when I look at everyday things that are going on, it does give me some concern. I was noticing the other day where it said that the school would be closed for altercations. And with peace raging throughout the country, it said in a later thing that clashes will be resumed tomorrow as usual. So there is some concern, but from the brighter side here, I'd like to call upon John Boyd, a graduate student in geophysics studying towards PhD, to address himself to the subject of abuses and uses of the library. John.
Well, that put me on the spot, didn't it? Of course, my experience with libraries is very specialized, and on other occasions I have tried to, or have been involved in, trying to make some attack on problems of libraries, and unfortunately most of the problems which impinge on one's consciousness have been just the problems outlined by Dr. Adams. But everybody pretty well has some idea of what we'd like to see in a library, and I think the main feature could be summed up as free access. We need rapid and good access to a large range of publications. I think generally more in terms of periodicals than in books, but this presumably differs with other disciplines. This requirement has to be balanced with a practical problem of how to achieve this access. And the academic tendency in me makes me repel at the idea of having to go to a librarian and say, give me page 321 of such and such a book, and she presses a button or something and it appears on a screen. I look at, no, that's not the one I want. I want page 322, which could get a bit tedious at times. On the other hand, I'd hate to have to go to the stack and find the particular book and that it's been stolen. And this happens quite frequently. I looked at this list of suggestions for possible thought, which was circulated to me some time ago, and struck me that it would be nice to be able to separate, perhaps, in our discussion, the aims, our main purposes of a library. Perhaps my idea of access is just one of a large number. I'm sure other people have lots of ideas. And then look at the practical aspects, because we're talking here about a very expensive operation, and this library, this whole library costs some millions of dollars, I'm not sure what it is. The Alaska taxpayers paid for a lot of this in one way or another, through bond issues and so on. If I were a legislator or something and came up here and sometimes in the afternoon and looked through, I'd wonder just what use is this library is being put to, and would of course inquire and find out that its usage is being based on a long-term goal, what the university will be like in 10 years, and so that'd be fine, but all the same, we have a problem of making sure that the right equipment, the right facilities are in the library, the right books. In my experience, in subjects in which I'm interested, a library has been defined by somewhat facetiously as a collection of obsolescent material. And this, I think, is a very big problem. A lot of space is taken up with books that hardly people don't look at all that often. Now, I know this is entirely in my own fields. I know it's different elsewhere. And so my feeling is that periodicals are the big problem, and the access to periodicals, and that is a continuing expense. Well, anyway, I went over a whole lot of ideas there, a number of which were generated on the spur of the moment, but I won't go on. I'd like to pick up some of these points later on, but those are some of the ideas, the areas at least, where I'm thinking and looking at problems.
Thanks, John. What if we could turn now to Peter Ray, who has a little different angle, let us say, from to the library as Vice President of Research and Advanced Study. Peter?
Well, I feel very guilty because I spent a good deal of time this morning trying to find an expert witness to bring here, but he wasn't to be located. So I have to quote this, make this statement secondhand. But it was reported to us yesterday morning by a dean, who will be nameless, that he'd been approached in his office by a student exuberant in the realization that he had just graduated. And the student seemed to feel that he should have some special recognition, possibly sine laude and something of this sort, put with his Bachelor of Arts, on the grounds that he had, and he felt he might be the first person who had ever graduated with ever putting his head inside the library. Whether this is clearly not use of a library, and I'm not even quite convinced it's abuse, I think we are developing an incredible, in this modern age, hang-up about libraries. There is a feeling that books must all be gathered together in some central repository, and the consumer has to, at convenience or inconvenience, go and read them there. Books individually are not desperately expensive items, certainly in this day and age in which well, if I might say most research workers, are dabbling with pieces of equipment that represent in cash value hundreds if not thousands of library books. I think it would be very interesting on this panel to discuss the possibilities of diversifying the collection and getting the books closer to the consumer, and making absolutely sure we're not buying jewels and putting them in a safe deposit box instead of wearing them. I don't agree entirely with George Adams that the modernization of library techniques, the automation which will allow one to press a button and get any selected page on a screen in front of one, is really going to save pilferage or economize. I think in point of fact it'll make the whole thing more exciting, because instead of stealing a book, you'll still steal a colored TV console. Certainly all I have to say at the moment.
Thanks, Peter. I've heard a new type now of protest. I've heard about burning books, but burning one's library card is a protest that I really hadn't understood. So this one who had got through school without using a library card to come in is a new anti-intellectualism protest that I had not encountered. I'd like to call upon now the present Academic Vice President Donald R. Theophilus to give his comments on abuses and uses.
For those of you who don't know, I have met Howard before, and we've had many, I would call, delightful conversations. I could have expected that he would have seized the initiative as he has and laying about on the various panel members. Two things strike me, Howard. One, the thread throughout these 15 items of interest, that 17 actually, that were distributed by Theodore Ryberg, all in one way or another have the implications of technology. And I think this is one of the critical things that will strike us as we move ahead in the library field. Technology, the implications of technology, and the psychological implications of that technology. Second point I'd like to make is one alluded to by John Boyd. I think increasingly in the future, that libraries are going to have to justify the allocation of resources to them. I think in a time past, and I don't think our current librarian would agree to this, that libraries have been equated with God and motherhood, and that they, in some respects, people have felt that they had a carte blanche to fund. I think this increasingly is going to be looked at with a jaundiced eye, and that people in the field, in the academic area, in the research area, but primarily in the field of the professional staff of the library are going to have to develop means to measure the usefulness and the effectiveness of libraries. Howard, that's all I have at the moment.
Don, you have a really easy job. If Ted Ryberg is the only one giving you the idea that he has a carte blanche to budget, all the deans behave that way towards me.
Well, certainly one member of the panel does, or vice versa.
Very fine. I'd like to call upon a member of the faculty, Professor Gordon Wright of the Department of Music and conductor of the University of Fairbanks Symphony Orchestra, for his viewpoints on uses and abuses of the library.
Thank you, Professor. As a Chichaco, as an inhabitant of this eco-structure, all the way to the other end of the complex. As a defender of anachronism, being a conductor of a symphony orchestra,
that's an interesting statement.
I'll go one step further and defend the anachronism of the book. I'm a book collector, and I love books very much. And I'm not sure I love the Xerox Corporation. I feel that a university has, as part of its obligations, an obligation to provide a center for the book, since the book is in many ways a symbol of our entire educational history. The abuse of the library, to my mind, which goes on very much, is the fact that it isn't used. It's not a matter, to me, of technology or microfilms or record players, but the fact that the books are here, and where are the people? And I think that it must start with the faculty, I think that the library administration would do well to educate the faculty how to use the library, and the faculty in turn to talk to their students how to use it. My own personal point of view, I look forward to the graduate program in music, musicology for the school, and I hope that the music holdings can reflect this as well, and that certainly is a bone of contention among the educators what place music has. But that's not the question. In general, I'm terribly impressed as a newcomer to the university with the library that's here. I didn't suffer very long in the old building. I wasn't sorry to leave Music Hall, and I think I came here knowing that this would all be here, and I'm very grateful, especially for the work that's been done so far.
Thank you. One's always in for surprises. I must confess that I hadn't expected that strong support in behalf of books, but really, I had really expected a support of the library as a sort of an instructional materials center, with music records and tapes, etc., rather than the library as a book depository. So I think maybe we can get some discussion out of this a little later, as really what is the definition of a library and what should be its functions. I'm delighted with your bringing the subject up of the definition. May we now turn to the beautiful side of this panel, Ms. Linda Welch, an undergraduate with a major in speech pathology in the College of Arts and Letters.
Thank you. Well, as a student and relating the library to university life, the idea of a library, just the word, has so many different meanings to students. I know some are in awe, some stay away, and some are proud, I suppose. The library has a personality, and students come to read their hometown paper or to keep up on the news by reading Time magazine or whichever magazine they choose. I think the main problem with a beautiful library like ours is that students don't really know what's here. There are the opportunity to come and listen, to type, to meet people in the lounging area. There are so many different opportunities that students don't realize are here. We should try to extend this library personality into really make it a part of what student life is, to make the library more a center of campus, to bring the students here, to give appeal to the idea of knowledge and of learning.
Thank you very much. Earl Beislein, Dean of the College of Earth Science and Mineral Industries, who has seen University of Alaska libraries for many years. Earl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My first thought is that with you here, Howard, there'd be no need for us to talk. And
you didn't think you could get a word in edgewise. Touche.
But I do have several comments, perhaps going back a little bit. I can think my first memory of the University of Alaska, or one of my first memories, I received